and welcome to Economics in 10 with Pete and Gav. In each podcast, we'll be looking at a famous economist and asking 10 questions that will hopefully inform you and get you thinking about their influence in modern society today. So, who are we looking at today, Pete? And why are they still so relevant?
Okay, Gavin. So today we are looking at Irving Fisher. And according to a previous podcast episode, Joseph Schumpeter, Fisher was the greatest economist America has ever produced.
Yeah.
And I've seen him described elsewhere as the first celebrity economist, if there is such a thing.
Yeah.
Do you think there's celebrity economists?
Tim Harford,
yeah, okay.
Potentially, do you think? Hao Jun Chang?
Yeah. You've seen Hao Jun Chang very recently, haven't you?
Yeah, it's exciting.
Okay, so the first of this long line of illustrious celebrity economists. Very relevant today in that one could argue his thinking helped inform the response to the financial crisis of 2008.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing about his relevance today, because the three dudes who've just won the Nobel Prize, including Ben Bernanke.
Yeah.
you could argue they've won it for Fisher's work.
Right.
Mm. I would, having now read about it, you kind of think, hold up a second, there's nothing original there.
quite harsh.
I know, people might come out there, but it genuinely looks that way.
Have you read their papers in detail?
Yeah, obviously. Funnily enough, though, they are.
I bet two of them
are Yale guys.
Okay. Well, I bet they credit, you know, Fisher.
Yeah, they probably do.
Yeah.
And Bernanke himself said, you know, I go, like, he was.
You're butchering Bernanke's name there, by the way.
Well, I was.
Call him Bernanke.
Oh, Bernanke, yeah. I mean, he said, didn't he, that he was the expert of the Great Depression. So if you're going to be the expert of the Great Depression, as you'll find out later, you've got to be a bit of an expert of Fisher, haven't you?
Yeah. I agree.
Oh, okay.
So we've established his importance as an economist, I think. So what we will do, as we have done in previous episodes, is we'll give a brief biography. We'll try and sort of set him in his time as well. Set him in his time. And then we'll go on and look at his key ideas before we move on and look at other fun things.
I would argue that I don't know what you're going to choose as his key ideas. But we're not going to do everything that he did, because he wrote, didn't he, so much.
I'm prolific,
not sure you can say
prolific.
It, but it, like, but also had fingers in so many different pies, which ultimately I think when we end up having chatted about this was probably his downfall as an economist, because he was kind of like a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
Rather than a kind of a master of one. There's a bit in the reading I was doing that he never kind of created this kind of big overriding theory like Keynes did.
Mm.
And it's kind of true. His mind seemed so bing, 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 that he just wanted to look at everything. It's incredible, the scope of his work, and we won't touch upon it.
No, but I mean, to be honest, most of our economists live long lives, and they're quite active throughout those long lives. So inevitably, we have to be selective about the work we're going to look at. Really fascinating chap, you know. Perhaps not as dramatic as some of the sort of biographies we've looked at, but still very interesting.
Yeah, incredibly interesting.
some real quirks, shall we say.
Yeah, let's crack on then.
He is born on February the 27th, 1867. And it's relatively long lived. He dies April 29th, 1947, at age 80. Yeah. So a long life, particularly for the time. He's born, I did look at the pronunciation of this, in Saugerties, New York State.
Right.
What do you think of that?
That was your best New York.
It's not that you're doing bad impressions.
No, you've matched me.
Get a piece of the action. So if you think about that, if lifespan sort of... spans, if you like, some fairly interesting times. He's born a couple of years after the end of the American Civil War, but lived through, you know, World War II as well. So incredible sort of events he would have sort of lived through.
Which he kind of predicted that World War II would happen.
Yeah,
in a roundabout way. He talks about like the debt that again, a bit like Keynes, you know, the debt that we're putting on Germany, he highlighted very early on this was a bad thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, certainly the period in which he grew up was boom time in America. I suppose during his lifetime, the US takes over from the UK as the sort of hegemonic sort of economy in the world. So, you know, the last three decades of the 19th century when Fisher's growing up, massive growth in the railroad network, partly facilitated by the development of cheaper and stronger steel. Edison patents his light bulb in 1880. And by 1890, you've got a reliable, I mean, there have been other sort of experiments in this international telegraph system of communication. So you think before that, it would take a long while before sort of messages sort of would get, certainly transatlantic sort of communication. And there's a real massive breakthroughs in some respects. You know, you talk about globalization sort of in the last sort of 20, 30 years, but there's a sort of explosion in, certainly American economic growth, American development, but also, you know, globalization, I suppose, which is facilitated by, I suppose, parallel sort of breakthroughs as we've had today. You could say the internet, you've got the telegraph.
Yeah.
But, you know, technological breakthroughs, but, you know, massive increase in GDP in America during that period. And industry is becoming much more sophisticated and more modern looking. You're getting the sort of the growth of professional managers. And in America, certainly, this is the era of the industrial giants or robber barons.
Yeah.
Depending on your perspective, you know, people like Carnegie, Rockefeller and JP Morgan. And interestingly, there are, you know, what economists like to call market corrections, you know, in other words, recessions in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And you could see these as precursors to the Great Depression, which was to have such an impact on Fisher, both professionally and personally.
Yeah. He writes about that, the you said about the railways and stuff like that. Because we did business cycles with Schumpeter, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah.
And he references quite a lot, doesn't he, I think, Schumpeter. And you can understand why Schumpeter thought he was really good.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of looking at... like you just said there, the railroads creating this boom, kind of new technology at the time and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Interestingly, though, I suppose when he's growing up, there isn't really, which you would get sort of as you move into the 20th century, is a modern welfare state. Or the widespread adoption of modern healthcare. And the lack of both of those, as we'll see, has a significant impact on Fisher's early adulthood.
Yeah. Can I just say, going back to globalisation, that's kind of just made me think a little bit about... when you read his stuff, you get a real sense that he is concerned that he hasn't copied anyone or whatever. And I wonder what it was like back then of knowing how quickly you would know what Europeans were writing and stuff like that. I mean, he does talk a lot about walrus or whatever, but like, you wonder how much of that, do you know what I mean?
It's interesting. Yeah, it's really interesting. I think if you go back through, I suppose, the development of knowledge generally, I always think of, as a case in point, like Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace separately. Because Alfred Russel Wallace lived just down the road from here in Hartford. But you kind of think, would they today develop separately the theory of evolution, almost in isolation of each other? Well, they can't have been that much in isolation of each other because they did sort of know about each other. But I don't know, you just wonder, would that sort of level of separation be possible today?
Because I think in his PhD, he says that he's developed this thing and he's... And he later finds out, I think, or Tobin points out that there is this thing that already, someone had already said this somewhere else. So what he was saying was brand new to him. Just a little side angle to look at.
I suppose whenever any sort of complex idea is developed, it's very unusual for it to be completely original.
Yeah.
I think we always overstate that. You know, you talk about the great man theory of history. It's almost like the great man sort of... theory of, you know, intellectuals, you know, even people like Marx and Freud, you know, they don't develop out of a vacuum. You know, they're sort of, I'm not saying they weren't brilliant men who sort of made major breakthroughs and sort of accelerated development in their chosen fields, but they weren't, you know, they had an intellectual sort of milieu in which they grew up.
Yeah, I think Stephen Johnson's written a brilliant book about that.
Right, okay.
I can't remember what it was called, but I just do remember at the time, like you're saying about this great man of whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just complete nonsense because it's basically loads of ideas just out there and then suddenly, boom, it gets tagged.
Yeah, and someone does bring them together in an original synthesis, but you know, those old ideas, you know, could Marx, for example, have existed at any other time apart from his own?
Yeah.
He would have needed all these other sort of strands perhaps that have come together before him. But anyway, we digress.
Yes.
So a little bit about, so I've not really done much about that, but I've covered the time in which he grew up in. Is there anything you wanted to add there before I move on to his individual biography?
Go on, go for it.
Yeah. So in terms of his family, his father, George, is a pastor in the New England Puritan Church. I thought Fisher himself looks a bit like a preacher.
Yeah.
Didn't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can imagine him going town to town and sort of preaching. Yeah. Particularly, you know,
well, he kind of did preach.
Yeah, you know, but that little sort of neat beard.
Yeah.
I just thought he looked like a preacher in sort of a Western, you know. Like.
Have you seen him speak?
No.
There is video of him.
Ah, right, okay.
On YouTube of him basically explaining a week after the great crash what's going on.
Yeah.
It's brilliant to watch. Yeah. One of them has got, someone's put subtitles on them.
Yeah.
And all the subtitles are completely
refuting.
They're completely wrong. Oh, like, you're listening to it going, oh no, he hasn't said that, what's just come off of the screen. It's like someone's like trying to work out what he said. It's really funny. As if like, a robot has listened to it and then churned it out. It's really funny. Anyway, but interesting hearing him speak, you know.
Yeah. Do you have a New York accent?
It's very, you know, like clipped and kind of quite posh.
Okay.
It was quite interesting.
Yeah, interesting. So his dad moves to another church in Saugerties, which is where Irving was born. I think he was invited there by a chap and he ended up marrying that chap's daughter, even though they didn't, and more of that later. They didn't really sort of socialise, particularly when they were growing up, Fisher and his future wife. Now, interestingly, in terms of Fisher's life history, his dad contracts tuberculosis in 1883. And at that time, that was pretty much a death sentence. And that's why I was sort of saying earlier, even though you look at him, he's a sort of a modern thinker. He's almost growing up in a transitional stage between the sort of pre-modern and the sort of modern world in which, you know, diseases like tuberculosis, certainly, you know, throughout the 20th century, are largely eradicated in the developed world, not internationally. I sort of looked up TB actually because I thought, is it? I know it's eradicated in the Western world, but in 2020, it was the second biggest cause of death by infection after COVID worldwide. So obviously, you know, when you've got countries where there's successful vaccination programs, but TB is still a massive killer. Yeah, because we got jabbed when you were at school, didn't you?
Yeah, it's quite surprising, isn't it?
Yeah, I've still got my TB scar on my arm. Yeah. But you kind of think about that, and I'll come out with my usual rant against anti-vaxxers, yeah? Because if I'd not had that, you know, you could die from a horrible disease like tuberculosis.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Fisher's dad.
They're very picky and choosy when it comes to vaccine, you know.
What, which ones they don't like?
Yeah. Just generally, it's like, who's the one who made this lot about, I don't know, some pop star basically complaining about not having a vaccine because he didn't know what he was putting into his body, and he'd spent like his whole life basically drinking and taking drugs and then
it wasn't Ian Brown, was it?
I can't remember. There's loads of them like that, and I read something the other day as well about someone saying, you know, when you give your kids cowpole, do you go and have a look at every single ingredient basically feed the kids that they're in their younger.
I think it's, unless you grow your own food, you know, you're not exactly sure ever what you're putting
into your body.
Yeah. Anyway, we digress. But his dad, and the point I was making, I suppose, is tuberculosis is a major sort of killer at the time. I suppose even in the 20th century, you know, things like polio were still major killers. Like Roosevelt, the American president, you know, contracted polio, and that sort of in effect left him partially paralysed, you know. So he's in that sort of transitional between our sort of modern world and you know, the end of sort of the pre-modern world, I guess. His dad dies just after his high school graduation. And Fisher was a very talented mathematician, already been accepted to Yale. But he finds at that point he has to support his family. And yeah. again, you think about that, it's again that sort of, there isn't a modern welfare state. People to a large degree, you know, barring charity, have to fend for themselves. And so he's having to take on that role as breadwinner, despite being still a very young man. Yeah. So whilst he's at Yale, he tutors pupils. You ever tutored pupils in the past? I used to tutor people.
Well, I try not to.
Yeah, no, but I've done it in the past. Yeah.
I know you've done
it. Liam, did you ever
Liam
do
Beer
it? That's not name names. Gavin is referring to sort of when in my very early days as a teacher and tutor, I used to get quite handsomely paid by a wealthy young man called Liam, who we nicknamed Liam Beer Money, because in effect, my tuition earnings did pay for the odd pint.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but a nice boy as well. He did very well on the back of my tuition, I'll have you
did
know.
Did he?
Yeah. I can't remember, actually.
I thought we always joked that we could teach him the same stuff every week because he couldn't remember it and you're still getting paid.
No comment.
But anyway.
No comment.
We'll carry on.
So
I'm sure Fisher was a very good tutor.
I'm sure he was. He won various prizes as well, which again, I don't think I've ever won many prizes. Have you ever won a prize? I won an art prize in year six.
Same year.
When it was about 10 or 11.
Yeah, I did as well.
And it was for a drawing of E.T., the extraterrestrial. Right. Yeah.
I do a country bumpkin with like cider barrels and won the ownership for a week of a Tony Hart picture.
Right. Did you? Well, that's quite impressive.
Yeah.
I won a fancy dress prize when I was in about year two.
Yeah, what
I look back now, I was quite humiliated by wearing this outfit, but I was an Easter egg.
Right.
Yeah. So I had arms and legs. So I just had this egg, which I was in, and arms and legs. You know, I look back now and I think, what was I thinking?
That sounds humiliating, but I think I won a fancy dress prize dressed up as Little Daddy, which was a play on, and I was just basically sent out in some lycra. That my parents had written Little Daddy on. Play against Big Daddy.
Okay, you win.
So if you don't know who that is, Big Daddy was a British wrestler, Shirley Crabtree.
And, iconic 1980s sort of television personality.
Exactly. And my parents would send us out with these kind of puns, every fancy dress. Like, so we didn't have a clue what we were doing. We just got suddenly, you go on stage and do this. And
we're
like,
I bet you were hated.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But how can I just say, so on that note about standing there in just lycra or whatever, I was the king. Who was the king who had no...
The Emperor's New Clothes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And so I was in that play when I was young. You wouldn't have this these days. And I was just standing there in my pants.
All right.
In front of the whole... I know. I wasn't like... Do you know what? I don't think you'd have that these days, would you?
No, probably not.
Like a little 8-year-old standing in his pants at everyone watching?
No.
Anyway...
Do you want to write about it?
That would be a chapter in my book.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think that kind of thing would make it into...
It would these days.
Prince Harry's book. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Fisher wins prizes for algebra and the classics. Right. So he's not a one-trick pony. He's not just sort of a mathematician. Obviously a very clever sort of chap. And whilst he's at Yale, in addition to tutoring people to support his family, he studies every social science course available. And... Even then, there's this desire to move beyond maths into some form of sort of practical sort of applications, if you like, of maths. There's a quote by him around that time in which he says, I want to read much. I want to write a great deal. I want to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And interestingly, he does all those things. Although the money aspect, there are... rises and falls in terms of his financial position, if you like. So he graduates in 1884 and he decides to stay on at Yale to do a PhD in mathematical economics, which I think he completes in 1891. Now Samuelson, chap we might cover in a future episode, describes his PhD thesis as the greatest doctoral thesis in economics ever written. And I should have looked it up and found out what it was about and read it. Did you?
Yeah, I have got it somewhere. But all I know is that it was the first pure economics PhD awarded by Yale.
Hmm.
So even though it was awarded by the mathematical department, you know, that was it. So it says it was a masterly exposition of Walrusian general equilibrium theory.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm. So there you go. Can I just say on that note, actually, related to that, we obviously did two podcasts ago, Phillips, and we talked about his Moniac machine.
Yeah.
And did you come across this?
No, carry on.
He built one, well, when was that? In 1891.
Wow.
So he says here that he produced a remarkable hydraulic mechanical analog model of a general equilibrium system replete with cisterns, valves, levers, balances, and cams. This could display physically how a shock to demand or supply in one of 10 interrelated markets altered prices and quantities in all markets and changed the incomes and consumption bundles of the various consumers. The model is described in detail in the book that he wrote. Unfortunately, both the original model and a second one constructed in 1925 have been lost to posterity.
Oh, that's a shame.
But what you find out about it, all the stuff we talked about with Phillips,
yeah.
I don't know if you say this later on, but he claims also that he discovered the Phillips curve. So he's got data, like, so you think, right, so the two things that Phillips is best about, the Moniac system and the Phillips curve, Fisher argues, or would argue, that he did all of that 30 years beforehand. Mm. Incredible stuff. I mean, this bloke is a talented boy.
Yeah, no, definitely, yeah. So, same year he finishes his PhD, he meets his wife-to-be, Margaret, or Margie, or Margie, I don't know how you pronounce it, I presume it's Margie, Hazard. It's actually her father who had invited Pastor Fisher, Irving's dad, to become minister of a congregational church that he had founded. But apparently they had not actually socialised growing up. They met as adults at a friend's house for dinner. So there we are. Now, he was marrying into money. Yeah, and he married in 1983, and you can tell he married into money because he undertook a 14-month honeymoon.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, did not come across that.
How long did you take for your honeymoon?
Week.
Yeah, I think we did about 12 days or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. In New England, funnily enough, or, you know, northeast, you know.
There you go.
Didn't go to Saugerties.
You know. Yeah. I'm sure now you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would, yeah.
Pay your respects.
So they travel around Europe, bit of work around the way, but whilst they're on their honeymoon, shows it's that different type of honeymoon, first child born. So not a honeymoon as I would understand it.
Wow.
Yeah. And they're also given a house with servants as a wedding gift.
Nice.
And again, I got some very generous wedding gifts, but I didn't get a house with servants. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you remember your best wedding gift?
No.
Do you remember any of your wedding gifts?
I just do know that excitement of going around Debenhams with a gun and going, we'll have that. You know when you're building up your wedding list?
Yeah.
And then I was getting really into it. And then my wife stopped me and said, give me the gun. I've been waiting all my life for this. And that was it. I never got the gun again. That was it. It was all over.
Quite right, too. Yeah, we didn't really, we sort of, because we'd lived in sin for a while before getting married, we didn't really need the sort of conventional stuff.
Yeah.
So we just ended up getting contributions towards our New England holiday.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah, very nice it was too. Yeah. And we did take in some economics, as you know. We went to the Bretton Woods.
Yes, and we've posted a photo of you looking like Keynes.
Yeah, yeah, the Bretton Woods Hotel where the gold room in that hotel. Yeah. Well, anyway, there we are. Sorry, I should explain that, shouldn't I? The gold room in the Bretton Woods sort of, I can't remember the name of the hotel now.
Mount Washington.
Mount Washington Hotel, yeah, is where the various treaties which formed the IMF and...
They can listen to our Keynes podcast all about that.
Yeah, well, they could, yeah. But I'm just explaining it to give it a bit of context. And... Yeah, I went there. It's a fantastic sort of play upon neck of the woods.
Yeah.
So there we are. So on his return from his honeymoon, he moves fully across to economics, away from maths. Yeah. So he's doing and does very well at Yale. And in 1898, he was given lifetime tenure. Yeah. was actually reading an article recently about tenure, saying that since the late 60s, there's been a real shift in a sort of academic departments in universities whereby less and less people are given sort of tenure or on their way to tenure.
Mm.
So it's a much more insecure position than it used to be.
I read, maybe it was the same similar article, about how a particular university wasn't given tenure because, you know, they were basically too anti kind of neoclassical economics or stuff. There's a lot of weird stuff related to tenure.
Yeah.
You know, anyway.
I don't know that much about it, but it's interesting. So, although, you know, obviously Yale is impressed by him, he's not particularly impressed by his fellow academics. I think it's fair to say he didn't think they were using their discipline to improve the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he would say, I'm putting words in his mouth, they didn't have skin in the game.
Yeah. Good.
Age 30, he gets TB himself.
Yeah.
And you can imagine if your dad's died of TB, you're sort of, you know, 30, that must have been quite a shock. And it takes him 3 years to fully recover from it. Because, you know, interestingly, you know, TB these days, you know, if you're vaccinated, you avoid it completely. And I think it is largely treatable, you know, by antibiotics, even if you do catch it without a vaccination. I'm sure it's not a pleasant experience, but I think it is eminently treatable. But obviously this is a period where it isn't. Now, not necessarily around this time, but it's fair to say, very fair to say, he is something of a health freak.
Yes.
he jogs, he does stretching, he's teetotal, he avoids all manner of things, which I think we see as some of life's pleasures.
Yeah.
Coffee, tea, chocolate, and he's largely vegetarian.
Yeah.
Yeah, though he doesn't call it vegetarianism. He calls it... I can't remember, I've written that down. I'll come back to that later. None of which actually would have been remotely fashionable or common at the time.
Mm.
So in a sense, he is something of an outlier.
It was part of that. What's the movement called, isn't it, where you don't drink? It begins with S, doesn't it?
I don't know. You know, in Ireland, you used to call it taking the pledge.
Yeah,
take the pledge not to drink anymore.
I wouldn't say sustenance movement, but it's not something like that.
Yeah.
Temperance
movement. Yeah. Oh, yeah, temperance, yeah.
Yeah. He was part of the temperance movement, wasn't he?
Yeah, and certainly, obviously in America, compared with the UK, the temperance movement led to a national outlawing.
Yeah, prohibition. And he was well for that. And
very much in favour of prohibition, really, and I think horrified when it was repealed.
And that's how he got his fame, wasn't it? Ultimately, in the first instance. This is what you're going to say?
I was going to say that. Much more famous as a kind of...
Diet guru
and health thinker. So in some respects, I suppose it emanates from concerns about his health. Plus, he did have a fairly puritanical upbringing, even though he wasn't religious himself. And he becomes an early proponent of sort of popular health initiatives.
Yeah.
So I was thinking he's a bit of a sort of Joe Wicks, Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, Paltrow than Wicks,
yeah,
I would argue.
Or Michael Mosley, that TV doctor who you don't like and I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, I read his book recently, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, Mosley's book.
Yeah, the one called Just One Thing. Well, I'd recommend it.
You can recommend it in the book section.
Yeah. So, just to give you some ideas of the changes I've made to my lifestyle on the back of reading that book.
Yeah.
I now balance on one foot whilst brushing my teeth.
Yeah.
And I have the last 30 seconds of my shower ice cold.
Yeah. You sound like Fisher now talking about that. That's the kind of crackpot stuff he'd be doing. But there you go.
It's evidence-based.
Yeah.
How long do you think you can balance on one leg for?
I used to do it with exam invigilation.
Did you?
It was one of those things that, I mean, when, in the old days when we all had to do exam, you don't do it anymore. I used to spend a lot of time seeing how long I could balance on both legs.
Yeah. So apparently the average person of your age, Kevin.
Yeah.
Can do 42 seconds.
I'll smash that.
You sound confident.
Yeah.
I don't get you on your feet there. Eyes open.
42 seconds of silence.
And 13 seconds eyes closed.
I'll be all over
Much that. More difficult eyes closed. If you try it, you should try it.
I will try it, but I'm trained. I'm a specialist. I mean, it's what exam invigilation was all about.
You're an Olympian.
Yeah, you know.
So anyway, this culminates in all this sort of health interest. He co-writes a popular book, How to Live, in 1915. It sells over 400,000 copies.
Loads.
Which is enormous, that's a huge amount. Yeah. And so in a sense, he becomes famous, but not for, economics, for this health book. Did you manage to read it? I've read bits of
it. You can read online. There's a PDF version of it, and it's really funny, I think.
Funny. I'll come back to bits of that later. But Project Gutenberg, which I think is a fantastic sort of initiative of, out of copyright books printed online, is on there.
Right.
Yeah. So I did read bits of it, and like yourself, I found it, bits of it, really, really funny. Yeah. Very pro-prohibition, as you've mentioned. And this health obsession and beliefs in sort of a kind of pseudo-scientific approach to health, there's a couple of darker moments in his life story which relate to that.
Nice.
So his daughter, Margaret, is diagnosed with schizophrenia, and he has her treated by a psychiatrist called Henry Cotton at New Jersey State Hospital at Trenton. And he believed, this guy Cotton, in what's called focal sepsis theory. And he believed that mental illness is to do with infectious material in the roots of teeth, bowels, and other places in the body.
Yeah.
So that sounds crackpot to me.
Yeah.
And this is really quite tragic. He, as a result of sort of his beliefs, he allows this surgeon to remove parts of her bowel and colon, and eventually it results in her death.
Blimey.
Interestingly, and this is where you really do get a sense of him being a sort of a bit of a nut rather than just an enthusiast, he still remains convinced of Cotton's treatment even after his daughter's died.
There's a lot in the book, isn't there, about fecal matter, I think.
Yeah.
I think he's quite slightly obsessed about looking at
stools.
Stools.
Yeah.
Which is your kind of classic stuff. Although stools can tell you a lot.
I'm not sure they tell me a lot.
Well, it can. You've got to look. I don't want to get too graphic about it, but you've got to look out for stuff.
It made me think, by the way, it's sort of the comparison with a kind of... Rosemary Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's sister.
Yeah, right.
But she was lobotomized in this sort of early sort of.
Right.
And before that, I think she'd been quite lively, maybe not as bright as the other kids. And they thought, there's something wrong with her. Oh, let's have this experimental treatment. And she ended up as, in a home, with a lot of, her faculties sort of no longer working.
Probably ADHD. Probably, isn't it? But something, stuff like that. It's the kind of stuff that in the old days, probably lobotomised after kids in our school now.
Plus, and I should say this, the other sort of darker aspect, not uncommon for his sort of era, he was a eugenicist.
Yes, another one.
Like Genie and like Keynes, to be fair.
Yeah.
Loads of people of that, even sort of who we might call progressives of that era, were eugenicists. I don't want to sort of talk about that much. I feel like we talked about that in earlier episodes, but it is not uncommon for the time, but still sort of quite depressing, particularly in retrospect when you see, where eugenics sort of ends.
Yeah.
And so, ends up not long after sort of Fisher's sort of period there. So you could argue he's got more than a reasonable salary as an Ivy League professor, but he's still supported by his wife. His wife was quite independently wealthy, and he was always very keen to make his fortune.
Yeah.
And now, apart from his health book, he develops an index card system.
Yes.
And that is taken up and eventually sells that company for $600,000, which at the time must have been tons of money. I mean, it's not small.
It's like a kind of rotary type thing.
Yeah, and, that makes him, sort of temporarily at least, very wealthy. Now, he invests heavily in stocks in the lead up to the Wall Street crash. Unlike loads of people at the time, he's individually geared. He's borrowing to invest in those stocks. He loses very heavily indeed after the stock market crash. And this plus unpaid taxes puts him in major difficulties.
Yeah.
Now, fortunately for him, his wife's elder sister, who had inherited the sort of family fortune, bailed him out. Even though she'd been hit quite hard by the stock market crash herself. So he owes a lot of money after that point, not least to her. Though, you know, interesting, she writes off all his debts to her when she dies herself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even with all of that, he has to sell his house, you know, the house he'd sort of given as a wedding present, to the university. They let him live there. But by 1941, he's got about 200 grand's worth of assets, but about a million worth of debt.
Mm.
So even sort of a little while after the crash has sort of maybe petered out, you can, so you can get a sense from that of how heavily he went into...
But that was his, that was his big downfall, was it? Because he said, this has reached a
permanent plateau.
I mean, that's the, that's the thing. It's a fascinating thing. And like I say, this video clip of him, which is about a week after, is him saying, look, this is the reason we've called it. It goes on about the bull market.
Yeah.
But he says, look, if we just calm down, don't worry, wait a couple of weeks, everything will be fine again.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like watching it thinking, because I was trying to look at the date on that. There's a date stamp. You know, when's he doing this? Oh, 29. And you think, oh, right, okay.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not the first and he won't be the last to sort of claim some kind of permanent plateau for the economy.
Yeah.
You think back to Gordon Brown, no more boom and bust. Yeah. And you think, well, that's not aged well, has it? You know.
Yeah, the folly of ill.
Yeah.
Hubris.
Hubris, yeah.
Mm.
So his wife dies in 1940. And he, unfortunately for him, given the sort of peaks that he'd reached, he lives out the last few years of his own life in sort of relatively, at least, modest circumstances. Mm. And his own his finances never really recover from the Wall Street crash. And this is some little sort of coda to his life. He kind of ignores a blockage in his bowels on the basis that, oh, my own clean living, you know, will clear it up. And it turns out to be a cancer, which if he'd been to the doctors earlier, likely would have been curable. Yeah. So he dies in 1947 and was buried next to his wife and daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
So there we are. So that's his life.
Nice.
Do you think we've said enough there? Is there anything you want to add? Any features of his life that I've not mentioned that you came across?
No, I don't. There is a bit later, but don't worry. No, that's fine. Okay. I've got a little quote here, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is too early for the quotes, but...
I've got some quotes later.
It's got here... he took, because you said about how he had to learn lots of things, but there's a bit in his book where he writes, to continue the subject in other books devoted to practical applications, such study of specific public questions will lead him into ever broadening fields of human interest. In fact, practical economic problems are seldom restricted to economics proper, but lead into the great realms of law, politics, and morals. This is because economics is only one branch of a greater subject, sociology.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What an interesting quote.
I know.
To be honest, I really do buy that, though, in the sense that, you know, you can't sort of just, you know, keep to economics. You know, think what economics is, you know, and, you know, it's, and ultimately it is a social science.
Well, that's what I find fascinating about that quote, is how economics looks down on sociology, isn't
it? Oh, God, yeah.
Like, massively so. And Liz Fisher, the greatest American economist ever, saying, yeah, it's a subset of sociology, which is the greatest. I know, exactly. Anyway, there you go. I thought I'd just share that quote.
Key ideas.
Yeah, let's crack on.
So the thing he's most associated with is something called the Fisher equation or the Fisher identity. And actually, when I started researching this, it turns out it was actually formulated by an economist or an astronomer called Simon Newcomb.
Yeah.
But in a sense, Fisher gives it legs. In other words, he talks about, you know, explains sort of how it works in theory. But I'll just explain the sort of different constituents of the formula. So the formula or identity is MV equals PT.
Yeah.
T is sometimes in textbooks Q or Y. So I'll just explain what those different elements are. M is the money supply. V is the velocity of circulation. I'll come back to all of these, by the way. P is the price level. And Q or Y or T is the sort of the volume of transactions in the economy, or, you know, GDP, if you like. Yeah? Okay?
Yeah.
Or, you know, real GDP. Yeah? Happy with that?
Yeah, keep going.
So the money supply is a sort of non-constant variable that could potentially expand. The velocity of circulation is The way I explain this to kids at school, and it's an oversimplification, but it's a sort of an interest, you know, perhaps an easy way of explaining it. Let's imagine you take £10 out of a cash point or an ATM, yeah? That £10 will not just be spent once, yeah? So that's sort of part of the money supply. It'll probably circulate around the economy several times during the course of a time period, let's say a year. And that is a fairly, according to Fisher at least, constant thing, this velocity of circulation. In other words, how many times that £10 or $10 note gets spent is fairly constant, you know, within a time period. So that's the velocity of circulation. So almost like the volume of units of currency in circulation multiplied by how many times those currency units are circulating is equal to the price level times the sort of economic activity in the economy. Yeah. Economic activity in the economy is sort of gradually increases in a fairly sort of steady way, according to Fisher. And what that means is if you try to increase the money supply, if the V bit of the equation is fairly constant and the Q bit of the equation is very constant, then increasing the money supply is simply going to increase the price level. In other words, this Fisher equation is a theoretical construct which supports the idea that increasing the money supply causes inflation. And in a sense, it is summarized more neatly by a later economist who we have also covered later, Milton Friedman. Inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a sense, this is, on the one hand, the support for the idea that increase in the money supply causes inflation. And you can see lots of evidence for that throughout history. You look, for example, when in the old world countries of Spain and Portugal, when they went over and basically robbed loads of gold and silver from South America, they bring that back to Europe. And then there's high inflation in Europe because, you know, at that time, the currencies were very heavily, well, they were in effect gold, you know, gold coins. So if you increase the money supply in those countries, it did cause inflation. So there's evidence there. There's evidence, you know, at various points in history where different sort of political regimes have printed money and that has led to inflation. So there's lots of sort of, you know, empirical cases supporting the idea that the money supply increasing causes increase in the price level.
Well, some people argue it's happened relatively recently.
Yeah, so
like COVID, I think we spoke about this, didn't we, in our cost of living special. Yeah. Some people blame, you know, just handing out checks.
Yeah.
America and over here with the furlough scheme.
Absolutely, yeah. And even before that, the banking crisis, some people would say, because we should say this, because you could argue this formula provide some kind of theoretical support to the quantitative easing which took place after the financial crisis. Because in a sense, to sort of crudely simplify it, I think there was a general belief that the velocity of circulation fell sort of after the financial crisis of 2008. Big crisis in confidence for both sort of consumers and firms. And therefore, if interest rates are already at as low a level as they possibly can be, and the velocity of circulation, or, you know, people still aren't spending money and this velocity is falling, you can safely, you know, without causing inflation, increase the money supply. Yeah. So in a sense, it's people sort of thinking of a slightly different application of the Fisher identity that's informing the actions which take place to address the financial crisis or the aftermath of the financial crisis. But you're absolutely right. Even at the time, there were some people saying, well, look, this sort of big increase in the money supply, we're just storing up problems for the future, you know. And some people would say that expansion of the money supply after the financial crisis, or even more recently, during the pandemic, that cash was stored, and now it's that unleashing of that cash that is perhaps at least partly explaining the rapid rise in inflation in the Western world.
Mm.
There are obviously other counter-arguments to that. Some people say, no, look, it's energy price increasing.
We've provided 10
because
10 factors.
Because of the, you know, the war in Ukraine. Yeah, but you're absolutely right. In our cost of living special, we talk a lot about different factors which might affect that. So in a sense, the Fisher identity or Fisher equation has been extremely influential.
That's how you would first come across him in a school setting.
Yeah, definitely. Other ideas which he introduced the idea of money illusion.
Yes.
Which is, you know, a very influential idea. The idea that people might confuse higher price levels with increase in economic activity when it could just be caused by increased money supply. Yeah. But temporarily, at least, people can be fooled by that and think, I'm getting more money. You know, they don't really realise that that, you know, they might be getting more money, but the price level's rising. They're not actually better off. Yeah. Okay. Another idea of his, and this is probably one that's less famous, but I found really interesting, is he believed that, and because he's writing at a time, or most of his writings are at a time when the dollar is linked to gold. And he said, well, that causes some quite sort of odd fluctuations. You know, the gold supply or the lack of it could cause a contraction or an expansion of the money supply. You know, it's not, that's not a situation we want to be in. So he believed the dollar should be fixed against certain commodities, a bit like a basket of goods rather than against gold, which is an interesting idea, because otherwise, you know, the money supply expands, it falls, dependent on, you know, how much gold there is in a country, which he found, you know, unhelpful and odd. Another idea of his, and I could keep going with this all night.
Keep going.
Index linking, you know, making sure that financial assets rise and fall with the price level.
Well, he was the first person who really came up with index numbers, didn't he?
Well, exactly, yeah.
And so, it, I mean, that is such a pivotal kind of part of
the application of it.
Of economics, like everything nowadays, isn't it? I mean, that's a classic kind of economics A-level question, index numbers.
And obviously, after having his fingers burned in the sort of Great Depression, he looked very closely at how debt-fueled bubbles develop and the negative impacts of deflation after a bubble bursts. You know, asset sales to repay debts are ineffective because, in effect, the real rate of interest increases in a deflationary period. So, in other words, as soon as you're trying to pay off your debts, but in effect, the real value of your debts is increasing during a sort of deflationary period. There's a quote from him. He describes it as, each dollar of debt still unpaid becomes a bigger dollar.
Yeah.
If you're in that kind of post-bubble bursting sort of deflationary period.
Yeah.
So a huge sort of range of ideas.
Can I just say that that debt deflation theory, I would argue, is what these three guys have won the Nobel Prize for.
Right.
You know, that is ultimately, you know, kind of having that understanding that the, yes, you have, you know, bad things happening in the economy, but when bad things really happen, it's that combination of debt and deflation. And when, and so he was saying about, you know, it's okay being kind of overconfident if it's just your money, but if you've borrowed money, you know, it's that debt element of it, which suddenly means that if the asset price falls and then suddenly you've got all these huge debts, and then that leads to bankruptcies, and then that leads to falling demand, and then that, you know, you get this kind of negative multiplier effect going on. He goes through, he says that there are nine events, and he talks about it from a logical order that we, you know, that that just goes round and round. So he says, these are the nine events. So debt liquidation leads to distress selling, and to second, contraction of deposit currency as bank loans are paid off, and to a slowing down of velocity of circulation. This contraction of deposits and of their velocity precipitated by distress selling causes three, fall in the level of prices. In other words, a swelling of the dollar. Assuming, as above stated, that this fall of prices is not interfered with by reflation or otherwise, there must be four, a still greater fall in the net worth of business, precipitating bankruptcies, and five, a like fall in profits, which in a capitalistic, that is a private profit society, leads to concerns which are running at a loss to make. Six, a reduction in output in trade and employment of labour. These losses, bankruptcies and employment, lead to seven, pessimism and loss of confidence, which in turn lead to A, hoarding and slowing down still more the velocity of circulation. The above eight changes cause nine, complicated disturbances in the rates of interest. A particular fall in the nominal or money rates and a rise in the real or commodity rates of interest. Now, he would argue, you know, in many respects, that explained for him why, you know, the Great Depression was so big and why he lost all his money. Yeah. And he was arguing at the time that there should have been this big intervention, you know, very Keynesian. This is what I found quite fascinating about it. You know, that the comparison about, you know, Veblen was this, so like Fisher was this kind of great man over in America, and yet Keynes was the one who suddenly took over. But he was having the same idea, again, like to say it's the same idea. But this is what's interesting is Bernanke kind of has studied that.
Yeah.
And because they didn't come in with a rescue package, when 2008 happens, he then comes in with the rescue package that Fisher would have advised, would have actually, he was kind of doing it out of self-interest. Because obviously if the package had come in, it would have rescued him and his money, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but even so, you know, would have rescued a lot of other people, is it, in addition to him?
But what's funny about the Nobel Prize, well, it's hugely criticised, wasn't it, Bernanke getting it, is that he was in control of the scenarios that led to the deflation kind of happening in the first place. It's like, well, yeah, you rescued it, but you were there in the you were supposed to be kind of moderating it. There is a bit in there, he said that there's a bit later on where he talks about how because of price stability being so important, that he envisaged a future where the role of central banks became even more important.
Right.
Which he was saying that in the
30s. Yeah.
So then fast forward to like the independence of the Bank of England and having that kind of autonomy is incredible. Yeah, incredible when you really think about it.
A far-sighted thing.
Yeah. It, like, that's what I found really fascinating about all of it. Yeah. But so within that, one of his big things was and we teach it, I think, in lessons now, Jesus even, nominal versus real interest.
Yeah,
and having an understanding of that,
that
if you're getting, you know, a nominal rate of 10% and inflation is 10%, in real terms, you've got no interest, you know. And so he was then, he came up with this theory. I mean, you can talk about the theory of interest.
No.
Well, that's the thing. That was his big thing. Like, the theory of interest, how does, you know, and this kind of idea of, you know, thinking ahead and, you know, giving up money for future consumption and stuff like that. And it's kind of really, it's a really interesting area, again, to look at. There's so many bits of
him. No, there are. I mean, this is the thing.
Fascinating.
I've inevitably been sort of selective in what I've chosen, but I think we've covered.
But there is so much. Yeah. This is the thing. I'm sorry, just going on about that financial crisis. One of the things that we spoke about previously before was one of his ideas is that there shouldn't be, was it fractional reserve bank? What's the thing? That they should only be able to lend out the money that they had.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, there shouldn't be fractional reserve banking,
And again, if you think about that, I mean, the big issue of the 2008 financial crisis was the fact that they were just lending money left, right and centre. Yeah.
I think that's another extreme, you know, though, to completely...
Oh, it is an extreme, but at the same time, again, having that appreciation of... knowing that that would ultimately stop overborrowing, as it were, which could end up causing these huge problems.
Yeah.
You know, incredible to read.
It always blows kids' minds, by the way, when you explain fractional banking.
Yeah.
They're just a bit like, what, you mean banks don't just lend what other people save there? Like, nope.
Yeah, I know. Yes,
it does. They're a bit like, it's a real, like, huh?
Yeah. And
you know, banks can create money. Huh?
Yeah.
You know.
And a lot of, you know, economists, they want that known more within wider society, don't they? Yeah. Ultimately, it's just adding some numbers up. It is interesting. I have one more thing to say. Oh, that was what I was going to say. Sorry, have you finished?
I finished it with the ideas, yeah. I've got a few quotes.
I just want to say, there's a video I watched, and I came across this when I was reading it, but it was interesting watching Steve Keen talk about it in a little video. Of him just going on and on and on about the fact that our economy, we draw every single day demand and supply diagrams in equilibrium. And he basically argues continually that equilibrium basically never happens.
Yeah.
So he talks about uses the kind of a boat. So to take another simile, such a disaster, something like the capsizing of a ship, which under ordinary conditions is always near staple equilibrium, until it gets like tipped over. And he talks about a rocking chair as well. Eventually it might come back to equilibrium, but often not. Something else comes along.
Yeah.
And then he then uses another one. He goes like, what does he say here? It is absurd to assume that for any long period of time, the variables in the economic organization or any part of them will stay put, in speech marks, in perfect equilibrium, as to assume that the Atlantic Ocean can ever be without a wave.
Yeah.
So we are teaching something that Fisher and most people probably understand, is that really we should be teaching a model of disequilibrium rather than what we are teaching at the moment of always discussing equilibrium. Yeah. And I suppose that's, and what's interesting again, like when we first started teaching, we probably talked about the cobweb theory, didn't we?
Yeah.
And that is ultimately what he's sort of talking about there, isn't it? And that's now been taken away from A-level teaching.
Yeah, but and in itself, that's just one limited sort of case of a kind of permanent disequilibrium.
Yeah, but at least it's there for people to think about, that we're always...
I do take your point, because in a sense, the implication is that the norm is static sort of equilibria, whereas actually the norm is probably constant flux.
Yeah. And then it's something like... this is the whole point about his importance of the debt deflation theory, is that suddenly something then happens, the debt deflation thing, that then tips that disequilibrium over the edge to create these huge depressions basically. But it's fascinating reading him about the business cycle, about you really get that appreciation as that so much is happening at any one moment in time. You do really, it's fascinating. But there's an article kind of linked to that, which is called Debt Deflation Theory of Great Depressions by Irving Fisher, which is fantastic.
We can share that.
Go on, you want to do some quotes?
Yeah, just a few quotes. I mean, again, he's quite a quotable sort of economist, if you like, but there's a few that I found particularly interesting. One which I think, to say it's not aged well, this is him at his peak just before he crashes. So stock prices have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. I do not feel there will be soon, if ever, a 50 or 60 point break from present levels, such as bears have predicted. I expect to see the stock market a good deal higher within a few months. And this is just before the Great Depression.
No, he's mad, isn't he?
But he's not the first. So he's not the first, and he's not the last to sort of think that things will always be sort of, good, if you like. Here's another one. Our society will always remain an unstable and explosive compound as long as political power is vested in the masses and economic power in the classes. In the end, one of these powers will rule. Either the plutocracy will buy up the democracy, or the democracy will vote away the plutocracy.
Yeah.
Isn't that a great quote? And sadly, I think we're
the former.
Yeah, the plutocracy has bought the democracy. It's amazing, maybe I see it more in America, but perhaps it's the same in the UK. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, you can see it with this week, the Westminster scandal that the Sky have been reporting on, of the amount of lobbying and money being paid to MPs and all this stuff.
So the plutocracy has bought the democracy. And one last about sort of economics. I always like to sort of get economists to sort of, what's their view of economics, if you like. And he describes it here. The effort of the economist is to picture the interplay of economic elements. The more clearly cut these elements appear in his vision, the better. The more elements he can grasp and hold in his mind at once, the better. The economic world is a misty region. The first explorers used unaided vision. Mathematics is the lantern by which what before was dimly visible now looms up in firm, bold outlines. The old phantasmagoria disappear. We see better. We also see further. So he's sort of obviously there. You've got to remember as well, he's one of the first mathematical economists.
Yeah.
So he's one of the first people to apply sort of complex maths to sort of try and solve economic problems.
Yeah.
And he certainly sees that as being very, very valuable. It'd be interesting to know whether, how much he would agree with how far that's gone.
Yeah.
In a sense, you could argue maths has overtaken to economics to the point that it doesn't allow people to see the interplay of economic elements. Mm. It's almost like math for math's sake, yeah, arguably. Right.
Yeah, okay. Good point. Okay, are we done there?
We're done.
Woo! As always, a long one. Okay, so what do the critics say about him or his ideas? In our Keynes podcast, we talked about the quote he may or may not have said, but always attributed to him, which is, if the facts change, I change my mind, what do you do? And one of the key criticisms of Fisher is that he didn't really change his mind, just dug himself a bigger and bigger hole that he never really recovered from.
Do you mean with respect to sort of the stock market?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that then just destroys his career.
Yeah, no, I mean, someone described his reputation during his lifetime was irreparably harmed.
Yeah.
By a public statement just 9 days before the Wall Street crash that the stock market had reached a permanently high plateau.
Yeah.
And he never really recovered from that. I suppose, positively, you know, you could say that his view, you know, that the mechanism of how the money supply interacts with the sort of real economy still holds water, and it helps inform the thinking behind the sort of the QE programs of 2008 onwards. I mean, there is a debate about his interpretation of the Fisher equation, which, as we've said, perhaps he didn't really devise anyway. Many would argue that V and T are not as constant as he made out. Even at the time, people would have said that. You know, they would have said, hang on, you've said V and T are constant. Mm. They're not. You know?
I think he would say that. I mean, it's a classic thing again. When you start reading a little bit more about it, he would, it's possibly like the devil in the details there.
One thing perhaps he couldn't have anticipated is just how complicated a beast the money supply is now. And I think that, and you see that really in the sort of monetarist experiments in the early 80s in sort of the UK and in America, where the UK government certainly set targets for the money supply, and it just ended up, it couldn't control the money supply. And what was interesting about that, because I certainly had to learn that as part of my level economics, was all the different measures of the money supply. Because in a modern sort of complex, deregulated capitalist economy, what is money? You know, what things are money? You know, obviously it's cash, but there's lots of other things which can be turned into cash quite quickly. And so you get things like narrow money, broad money. Yeah. And certainly the government at the time just kept thinking, oh, we want to control the money supply to bring down inflation. And then they set one target for one sort of form of the money supply, didn't hit it. They moved to a different one. Well, we've not really missed that one again until quietly.
Yeah.
Sort of they abandoned that attempt to directly control the money supply. Because ultimately the money supply from the mid-70s onwards, you know, before that you've got currencies pegged to the dollar. You've got fairly, you know, regulated financial capital markets. But after that, it's almost impossible for one national government to control the money supply in its own country, even. Mm. Particularly once all sort of national currencies are no longer pegged to the dollar. So in a sense, what countries do now, or central banks generally, is they sort of indirectly control the cost of money, you know, with a view to sort of almost managing the demand through the interest rate. But certainly the attempts, and that's not criticism of Fisher, but the attempts to control the money supply, I suppose inspired by the Fisher equation, they failed, you know. I suppose the idea of money illusion, you could argue it's had its day. I mean, you'll see that in sort of union sort of strike. Is anyone really sort of a victim of money illusion these days, you know? Maybe some people are, but maybe it wasn't as widespread even at the time as Fisher would have said, would have sort of thought. But certainly without question, his work helped inform the response to the 2008 financial crisis. And it's kind of this fear of debt deflation and a repeat of the Great Depression that leads to the various policies, which, you know, Gordon Brown from this country helped coordinate.
Yeah, save the world.
You know, the major expansion of the money supply via the QE process, you know, it's informed by the Fisher, you know, equation.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it, that debt deflation thing, he was a call for reflation.
Mm.
And then how do you do reflation? You kind of pump money into the money into the system, then it goes against sort of his MV equals PT. It's quite interesting.
Yeah. Or does it, you know, because if, you know, V's gone down.
Oh, I suppose, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, trying to get that confidence back. That's all he was kind of basically saying, wasn't it? Anything else?
No, I don't think so. In terms of critics, anything else? I mean, this
is what I find again fascinating is that he had the criticisms was about him being like a flop within his time, as it were.
Yeah.
And so that is kind of like there's a bias there, I suppose, in terms of at the time they think. But if you read around the subject now, he is getting his dues big time. No, like I say, that and the Nobel Prize definitely you could link to Fisher.
Yeah.
I've got a piece somewhere by Thaler, you know, saying that he was the first behavioural kind of economist.
Yeah.
You know, that Tobin writes an amazing like piece about him.
Another, Samuelson, the quote earlier.
All of them.
Schumpeter.
It says here, addressing the president of Yale shortly after Fisher's death. I know you kind of said this a little bit. Joseph Schumpeter and 18 colleagues in the Harvard Economics Department wrote, "No American has contributed more to the advancement of his chosen subject. The name of that great economist in America has a secure place in the history of his subject and of his country." And yet here is a man who's basically sort of been forgotten about.
Yeah.
But now he's having his time again.
Every dog has its day.
Exactly. Right. Okay. Food time. Very exciting. What are we eating today, Pete? There's a spurious link with Fisher.
Okay.
It's got to be something healthy without booze. Did you come across Fletcherism?
No.
So, Horace Fletcher
invented
this thing, or something like this. This was one of the food fads that he was really involved in.
Yeah.
So, Fletcherism is basically you take your food and you chew it and 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 chew it. And eventually it turns into a liquid. You absorb the liquid. You spit out anything left. So basically, you don't eat chunks of meat because they felt that was bad for the gut.
Yeah.
And it was, again, kind of seen as a pseudo kind of science. But having said that, mindfulness in eating and chewing has, again, had a revival in terms of saying, look, it's really, really important.
Well,
but the gut does need, apparently, chunks of food in order for it to work properly. So it's kind of quite interesting. But I know lots of people like hearing me chew, but I will certainly not be doing Fletcherism for our listeners tonight.
Well, you'll wait and see. So, in his book, How to Live Well, he rules out a fair few things.
Right.
So, amongst the worst foods, this is a quote, are putrefactive cheeses, sweetbreads, liver, kidneys, high game, or poultry. I thought chicken was quite healthy.
What's high game?
I think it's like pheasants you've left outside for a bit.
To be honest, that, what he's just said, would probably be really good for my gout. Wouldn't it? That's
what you mean to rule those things
out? Yeah. I mean, he's probably helping me here.
Now, he does say that we must masticate thoroughly.
That's the one I'm talking about. That's Fletcherism.
He talks about this at length.
Yeah.
quote here. Hard foods, that is foods that resist the pressure of the teeth, like crusts, toast, hard biscuits or crackers, hard fruits, fibrous vegetables and nuts are an extremely important feature of a hygienic diet. Hard foods require chewing. Yeah. Anyway, he goes on. Stale and crusty bread is preferable to soft, fresh bread and rolls on which so many people insist. It's quite judgy. Yeah. The Igorots of the Philippines have perfect teeth so long as they live on hard, coarse foods. But civilization ruins their teeth when they change to our soft foods.
Mm.
So he doesn't like much. So among the best foods for most people are fruits, potatoes, nuts, if well masticated.
Yeah.
Milk, sour milk and vegetables. And he did say about stools. The odour and character of the stools are indicative of the extent to which our diet is injuring us. The odour is less offensive if the diet is low in protein and thoroughly masticated. So not relatively little meat.
Yeah.
And loads of mastication.
Yeah. it reduces the smell.
Yeah, apparently.
Okay.
Yeah, interestingly.
So someone with a good diet, basically, you wouldn't know they've been to the toilet.
Yeah, yeah.
According to Fisher.
Yeah, it just smells like perfume.
To be honest, that's probably still true.
Yeah. He sort of poo-poos the old thing of like starve a cold, starve a fever. It's nonsense. Yeah. He says so much about this. Yeah, not keen on meat. I think he wasn't quite a vegetarian, but almost. He calls vegetarians, I don't know when the word vegetarian became popular, but he calls them flesh abstainers. And he does quite a lot of like research on the health benefits of, or the health gains from being a flesh abstainer.
Yeah.
I think I read a Guardian article over Christmas, and one person's New Year's resolution would say if they were asked that, not they were a vegetarian, but they didn't eat animals.
Yeah, a flesh abstainer really visualises it, doesn't
it? Yeah, I abstain from flesh. Yeah.
Well, what were we eating?
I've got one more thing to say. You're going to be really disappointed.
All right.
Yeah. Sorry. You're going to be really disappointed. Anyway, so he's well ahead of his time. One thing he does in that book as an appendix, he does calorie counts of different types of foodstuffs.
Right.
It's kind of what you get in restaurants today,
exactly.
Isn't it?
He's such a forward thinker.
Yeah, forward thinker. Anyway, what you've got, we're going to do a kind of taste test.
Right.
I'm going to give you two hard crackers.
All right.
I'm going to see which induces the most mastication. So it's a kind of scientific experiment.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to go off and get you a crackers.
Hey. Yeah.
All right. So 1 second. Right, so are you ready for your taste test?
Are we in?
Yeah.
Okay.
So right. You've got two crackers.
Yeah.
So that's classic cream cracker.
Mm.
So I don't think that's as hard as the other one. Yeah.
Mm. So, from a mastication point of view.
Yeah. Well, where would you rate it? If you had to sort of put it on a mastication scale of 1 to 10, what would that be?
Six.
Six, okay. And this is a sourdough cracker. Yeah. You're sort of going through my classier sort of cheese biscuit sort of range here.
Oh, yeah, it's tougher.
And is it?
It's tastier.
Oh, good. Yeah, high praise.
Mm, but, you have to work a little bit harder with that.
Yeah.
I say that's an 8.
An 8? Wow. Mm. So are you feeling the health benefits?
Yeah, already I feel my mastication levels... really, really gone up. Thank you very much for providing that.
That's marvellous. Went to a huge amount of effort.
Now, before we move on to the next question, it is quiz time.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that we haven't spoken about,
yeah,
and I've saved it for this quiz, is that as Yale, he was part of the famous Skull and Bones Society.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah.
Or otherwise known as the Brotherhood of Death.
Oh, I didn't know it's called that, but yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard
so
of it.
So very famous because it's like known for conspiracy theories and all this kind of stuff like that. And being portrayed in films and, you know, it's a really interesting one. Irving Fisher in 1888 was a bonesman.
Right, okay.
Right, so you get specially selected because he was quite good. I think he was an athlete. You said about some awards, didn't he, that he won?
Yeah, yeah.
I think he got chosen because of that.
Right.
So I'm going to give you basically 10 people.
10?
Yeah.
That's quite a lot, yeah.
I know, but I think you'll get this. Oh, and by the way, what interesting about Bozeman, they were all given a nickname.
Yeah.
I can't remember what Irving Fisher's was, but anyway, here we go. Who are Bonesmen?
Yeah, of the following. Yeah.
Who are not Bonesmen?
So I just have to say...
Yeah. Okay.
Yes or no?
George H.W. Bush.
Bonesman.
Correct. Actor Bradley Cooper.
Not a Bonesman.
Correct.
Did he go to Yale?
No, I just made that one up.
All right, okay.
Theodore Roosevelt.
Gotta be a Bonesman.
No.
Really?
He didn't even go to university. I don't think.
I think, do you know what? Yeah, I'll come to it. I think it'll be one of the other options.
Rushed in there.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
His predecessor, William Howard Taft, was. That's the reason I chose Israel. George W. Bush.
Non-bonesman.
He was a bonesman.
Ah.
And the what's funny about him is knowing about him now. His bonesman nickname was Fog.
Right.
Which is kind of quite interesting. Jimmy Carter.
Non-bonesman.
Correct.
Yeah, I don't think he went to Yale.
Okay. John Kerry. VP.
I thought he was a Harvard sort of dude, but I could be making that up. Non-bonesman.
He was a bonesman.
Oh, God. I'm the mayor.
Okay. Actor Paul Giamatti.
I don't know who he is.
He's in Sideways. Have you seen the film Sideways?
No. I'm going to say non-bonesman.
I know he was a bonesman. I thought you'd get that because of that. 2022 Economics Nobel Prize winner Douglas W. Diamond.
Bonesman.
No. Went to Yale, but not a bonesman. Final one, 2018 Economics Nobel Prize winner William Nordhaus.
Bonesman.
Correct.
I just said bonesman to all of them, right?
Yeah, I think you did. Well, so what did you get? You got 1, 2, 3 I think you got 5 correct there.
Oh,
out of the 10, I think. Yeah, yeah, so well done.
I thought, do you know what, I think, did Filano, not Filano, FDR, Delano, Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, did he not go, yeah?
Might have done, I don't know. What they've done, actually, is funny enough, that one about when I said Douglas W. Diamond, the 2022, he went to Yale, I think, they don't reveal the Crust and Bones names anymore. It's a secret society. Like when the Bush was kind of asked about it, he said, I can't say. It's a secret society. Okay. Yeah. So they don't actually release the names anymore. When in the old days, they did release the names. He didn't.
I think he went to Harvard.
Quite interesting about the Bonesmen or Skull and Bones Club, about how they resisted a female members for a mighty long time. I think it's like 92 or something like that. It's so they eventually let females in. So anyway, that's the quiz over. Yeah, okay, let's crack on.
Yeah.
Everyone is always interested in who the next Bond would be. Do we think Fisher would make a good Bond?
Well, do you know what? When I was reading about him, I couldn't think of him as Bond.
Yeah.
But if you read the book Thunderball, obviously in the film.
Yeah, well, I'm aware of Thunderball.
Yeah. So you have to bear with me here a bit. Mm. But Bond goes to a health farm and he's given lots of healthy food.
Right.
And it really reminded me of Fisher because when he goes back to his landlady in the book, she's disgusted that he's given up bacon and egg. Oh. You know, as his normal breakfast in favour of some Fisher type health food. And later on, as I recall, he goes back to his bacon and egg and he's able to be a proper spy again, like killing people and so on. So, yeah, I don't know why, but it's the only link I could make between Fisher and Bond. I don't think they would have got on. I think Fisher would have disapproved of Bond's drinking and sort of...
I think you could imagine him as a Q figure.
Yeah.
You know... But that's probably about it.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, okay, we're going to say no to that. Yeah. What books would we recommend if people wanted to learn more about Fisher and his ideas?
Well, I think we recommend this pretty much every time, but Linda Yue's book has got a really good summary of Fisher and his work and his biography, and also, you know, how you might apply his ideas today. I think... You should read his book, How to Live Well, on Project Gutenberg. Really interesting. There's a couple of recommendations from me.
Okay. I've got My Father, Irving Fisher, by Irving Norton Fisher.
Right.
Okay. Basically, they've set up this big library of all of his work at Yale. And it's Irving Norton Fisher who set it up.
Oh,
and
right,
so you can go. But he's basically written an autobiography about it. It's very expensive. You can go and get it. There's an interesting book that's recently come out called by Edward Chancellor called The Price of Time, The Real Story of Interest. And there's loads of stuff about Fisher in there.
Yeah.
There was also another one I was going to recommend. The person who wrote A Beautiful Mind, Sylvia someone, can't remember. She has got a book that talks about kind of great economists.
Right.
And again, Fisher and kind of Keynes gets kind of compared within that book. And apparently it's a brilliant book. And I'm looking to get that quite soon.
Sylvia Nassar.
Yeah. And does it say what her book is?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh. Okay.
The other one, sorry, I should recommend, just because I think we've talked a lot about the financial crisis. I'm listening as an audio book to Adam Tooze's Crashed.
Yeah.
Which I'm... it's quite hard work, but it is really interesting. Right, but you do have to concentrate quite hard, you know. It's a sort of very sort of erudite, very well-researched sort of book just about the causes and aftermath of the financial crisis.
Did you look up Sylvia's book?
No. Well, there's one called Grand Pursuit.
Yes, that's it, Grand Pursuit. Yeah. Okay, and then finally, we should probably say modern day people. Michael Mosley is a really good example of that. If you want to
try just one thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really interesting one. I mean, one part of the book that he wrote was about how eating poorly can lead to baldness.
Yeah, so if that explained to me.
Well, I thought that was one of those kind of classic things where you think, that's pseudoscience. And then I looked up, actually, that there is a link between income poverty and hair loss.
Well,
if you don't eat well...
Well, be a little cue ball like yourself.
If Fisher was a boxer, what would his walk-on music be and why?
Okay, because he's quite a clean-living guy.
Yeah.
I've got goody two shoes, Adamant.
Nice.
Don't drink, don't smoke. What do you do?
Yeah, I like that.
And then in a similar vein, the late Jermaine Stewart's, we don't have to take our clothes off to have a good time. We could dance and party all night and drink some cherry wine.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I didn't realise that he was dead.
Yeah, Jermaine Stewart.
Yeah, and really sadly, his burial site had no tombstone or even a grave marker for over 17 years.
That is sad.
And in 2014, a fan bought him a gravestone, paid for a non.
Sad little tale there. Yeah. I don't think he'd be a party person, but maybe I'm wrong there.
I don't think he was. No.
No. So there you go. Anything else?
No.
Okay, I've got a few.
Go on, Ed.
If I could turn back time.
Is that sort of before the crash?
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha.
Share. Yeah. The Choo Choo song by The Wiggles. Did you ever get into The Wiggles with you in the Kiddy Winkles?
Not really.
Yeah.
Why the Choo Choo song?
Because he goes on about chewing food a lot.
Oh, Choo Choo. I thought you meant trains.
No, it's about chewing your food properly. Right, okay. It's about masticating. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole song about it. By The Wiggles, and if you don't know who The Wiggles are, look them up.
They're sort of, the Australian.
Yeah. Or maybe New Zealand, I don't know. Now, we've mentioned Merle Haggard before.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I can't remember what episode it was. Merle Haggard is a country music singer.
Yeah, no, I'm aware of that.
Who basically does economic songs, and he has a song called How Long Will Interest Rates Stay Low?
Right. Okay.
Okay. Finally. Oh, no, it's not finally. The Gambler by Kenny Rogers.
Oh, yeah.
Because, just listen to these lyrics. I mean, this is classic Fisher, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, and know when to run.
Uh-huh.
You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
Oh.
I mean, that is...
That's his life.
Fisher. But final thing.
Final thing.
There is a recording that you can get for a gramophone.
Right.
And it's about basically smiling.
Yeah.
You know, and if you smile, whatever.
Yeah.
It's by Irving Fisher.
No.
Yeah, and I've been digging around trying to find out.
Is it the Irving?
Yeah, him singing this song. And it just does literally always go back to Irving Fisher, but there's nothing concrete to suggest it is Irving Fisher. Well. But it wouldn't surprise me if it was Irving Fisher.
At all,
no, exactly. Got a lovely singing voice.
Well, we don't know that, but...
No, we do, because you can listen to it. It's on YouTube.
Oh, and it sounds like Irving.
It sounds like a man singing that could be him. But there you go. Anyway, what are we going to go for? I like Goody Two Shoes. I think that's very good.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Is it Poetry Corner?
I think it's Poetry Corner.
Yeah, well, this is very exciting. Because today,
yeah,
we've got two poems.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, what the listeners have to do at home is you're going to obviously ask the first question.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to read two poems.
Okay.
And, well, I'll explain why in a moment. Okay. So you're the top two lines, Nippy.
Who's the economist that lost all his money after hedging his bets on a quick recovery?
Irving Fisher is the man that you mean, and the Great Depression killed his dream of making him rich, as rich as can be. But his equation of MV equals PT made him an economics household name. Yet after the loss, he was never the same. Supported by his in-laws, he became ignored. As the statue of Keynes soared and soared, but Schumpeter described him as a true great who developed a theory of the interest rate and how money supply impacts inflation whilst trying to improve the health of the nation. He developed indexes to measure prices with an entrepreneur with his index devices. He understood the powerful threat of deflation and even anticipated the League of Nations. He wrote book after book after book after book. If you don't believe me, take a look. And his theories on banking would have been great to stop the financial crisis of 2008. With Ben Bernanke winning the Nobel Prize, it should probably come as no surprise that the ideas of Fisher are back in the news and finally Irving is getting his dues.
I like that, yeah.
Thanks. It did remind me, sorry, just quickly, we didn't mention that. He was in the ear of a president talking about the League of Nations.
I did come across that.
And there was a link there to game theory. Again, he predicted that. He said, look, if we all pool our resources, you can spend less, but obviously the threat of every country coming at you will mean that you get mutually assured destruction. Again, what, 20 years before Nash? Yeah. So anyway, fascinating. Here's the second poem. Irving Fisher, a man of great renown, his theory of interest forever known. But alas, his wealth did quickly drown. In the stock market crash, he was overthrown. A member of Skull and Bones, a Yale elite, but his riches did not shield him from defeat. His wealth, it did evaporate, leaving him in a sorry state. But his legacy lives on. In the words he wrote on the subject of money, he was quite devoted. Through his fortune may be gone, his ideas live on. They live on and on.
Yeah.
What do you make of that poem?
I prefer the first one, but yeah, why did you write two?
The second one was written by ChatGPT.
Who's ChatGPT?
Well, it's the new AI engine that everyone's been talking about. It took me about 40 minutes to write that first poem.
Yeah.
ChatGPT, after writing a poem about Fisher, wrote that in about 5 seconds. It's incredible. And in fact, Econosaurus, who tweets as Econosaurus, it's not Econosaurus, it's Isabel, saying that when she came across some of the poems on it, she said it did remind her of my poetry for these podcasts.
Well,
I don't know whether that's an insult, isn't it?
Well,
I think
I preferred the first one.
Yes, man beats machine.
Yeah.
Thank you, Pete.
It's like the early days of chess computers. At some point, you'll be overpowered. The whole podcast will be.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I could get ChatGPT to write our scripts now. Anyway.
Scripts.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it will keep us under time. Yeah. So, do we like him? Would we have a beer with him?
Well, we definitely want to have a beer with him. We could go for a jog with him.
Yeah.
Do a few squats.
We're quite healthy, aren't we?
Yeah, well, sort of, yeah. You've got your gout, but, you know, and your bald head.
Yeah, but I think we'd appreciate his wisdom, I think, on certain things.
Yeah, he was quite serious, apparently. Yeah. I'm not sure he's a fun-loving guy, but I think we'd find him interesting.
Yeah. I don't think he'd want to spend time with us.
No.
But then I don't think many of the economists would. We always say this, don't we? So
we could go for running with him, though.
Yes.
He'd like that. We all like running.
Yeah.
That's our little sort of Venn diagram with Fisher.
Okay, yeah. That's nice. He did say, he wrote to his wife that his ambition was to be a great man. Yeah. And I think that's a lovely thing, wasn't it? That we could maybe talk about and discuss.
Yeah, so you are a great man, Irving.
Yeah. We could bolster, you know. Yeah. Okay. New question alert. If we were out with him, what one question would we ask him and why?
Well, I'd be quite interested to think what his views on modern monetary theory.
Yeah.
Good, I'd probably get his take on that.
Good question.
I'd also ask him, I'd say, have a look at me, Irving. What can I do to improve my health? And he'll look at me, nudge you your food.
Yeah.
Masticate.
You need to chew more. Yeah.
Now, I'd probably ask him about sort of the current monetary setup in the UK. You know, is it fit for purpose?
But I made deep questions.
What would you ask him?
As always. I'd like to know if he sang on that record. I mean, it's a very... I mean, all my questions are pretty basic. Or
how much did you lose?
Yeah, exactly.
How much, peak to trough.
What did you have to say to your sister-in-law for you to get that money off?
Yeah. Oh, I'm really sorry.
Anyway, there you go. Right. Who is it next time? What's happening next? What's going on?
I don't know. We have had a recommendation, haven't we, someone to look into?
Yeah, Harjun Chang suggested Herbert Simon for us. But yeah. I think we've agreed Ronald Coase, haven't we?
We've talked to him. It's been so long.
I know.
I'm happy with either of them.
Yeah, Coase. Or I suggested Herman, who's recently died.
Herman Daly.
Herman Daly.
Any of those, I think, would be really interesting.
Well, look out for that. Whatever we decide,
yeah,
it could be one of those three guys.
All of which would be fascinating.
Yeah. Okay, right. So, we would like to thank you for listening and hope that you'll listen to our next podcast. We'd also like to thank our friend Nick, as always, who gave us technical advice with regards to podcasting. And please do follow us on Twitter and Instagram at EconomicsIn10 or contact us by email at economicsin10@gmail.com. You know, at this point, I mean, since our last podcast, we've been voted third for best independent podcast on the PodBible Poll Awards. So we'd like to thank all our listeners for voting for us. And that got us basically a top five spot for 4 years running now in the Oh My Pod independent podcast list. So we are so delighted that we have that. And I know that we've also sent out a few things recently, a bit of merch. We know Harjun Chang has now got a badge with Economics in 10. We've got a few other people who've got water bottles out there. You know, get in contact with us. We like to send out like little gifts.
Yeah, we're not bribing you to like us, but you know.
There you go. But thanks very much for listening.
Yeah, and if you do want to contact us, economicsin10@gmail.com. It'd be lovely to hear from you. And if you do want to review us on iTunes or any other sort of podcast reviewing platform, had a nice review recently from Pastor Mathematica, whoever that may be. Yeah. So thank you for that. But anyone wants to review us, good or bad, you know, we don't mind. We quite like to. We're just desperate for the involvement.
Yeah.
So,
good night. Thank you very much.
Thank you.